Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 14th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Blong touts development's benefits. City Council approves two measures related to entertainment retail center. By Stuart Doreen. Mayor-elect Lori Blong stated a proposed entertainment and retail center in West Midland will, quote, stop some of the retail leakage, unquote, that is currently taking place. On Tuesday, the Midland City Council approved two measures that were on the City of Midland agenda related to the proposed development of a 17.2-acre tract of land northwest of the intersection at State Highway 191 and State Highway 158. The first authorized the execution of a letter of intent between the City, the Midland Development Corporation, and Hodges Development Services. The second agenda item created a tax abatement reinvestment zone at that location. This letter of intent and the opportunity for the development is a chance for us to stop some of the retail leakage, to retain some of the retail dollars which many people currently spend outside our market, Blong wrote. This is a chance to keep our dollars in Midland. The project at the area that Costco once considered developing will consist of a lot for a 60,000-square-foot family cinema and entertainment center, complete with an outdoor music and event stage, a 60,000-square-foot lot to be occupied by a nationally recognized retailer, platted lots for other general retailers and restaurants. Blong added that the development group is committed to a high-end retail and commercial center, which would be a step in the right direction as we see Midland and Odessa continue to grow together. This potential development would also bring roads, sewer, and water to the adjacent tracks on that side of the highway and provide future economic benefit to developers in the area. She also stated that Midland leaders know, based on discussions from residents, that the community wants additional family-friendly shopping and entertainment options. Both agenda items passed unanimously and without any council discussion. In fact, there were no speakers for the public hearing that was part of the creation of a tax abatement reinvestment zone. Non-disclosure agreements prevent the disclosure of the specific names involved in the development. Officials afterwards said they hope an agreement could happen by the early part of 2023. The agreement between Hodges, the MDC, and City of Midland calls for construction to begin by September 1, 2023, with completion no later than January 1, 2027. Previous Reporter Telegram articles have stated Hodges will invest $45 million in the project, and MDC is being asked to contribute $5 million to fund the roads and other infrastructure. Those new roads will become city roads once complete. The letter of intent includes city property tax abatements over a period of 10 years, dropping from 100% the first 2 years to 20% the final 2 years. It also includes a city sales tax rebate, 50% generated by the cinema and entertainment center and the retailer, as well as the general retailers and restaurants for the first 7 years they are open to the public. The letter of intent, which was approved in Council Tuesday, is the first step in the process, and it provides an opportunity for residents to speak to their representatives at the city and the MDC, Blong wrote. The goal of Hodges Development Services to open up commercial development on the northwest corner of Highway 191 and Highway 158 is a benefit to the growth and future development of that corridor in West Midland. This article is entitled Council Votes for $17.5 Million Radio System Project by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council voted to upgrade the Midland Police Department's radio system at a total project cost of $17.587 million. The change will allow MPD to communicate with sheriff's offices in Midland and Ector County, the Odessa Police Department, and the Department of Public Safety, something MPD Chief Seth Herman said was paramount to the job, and allows for joint operations capability that the current radio system does not allow. The radio system comes at a discount to the Midland taxpayer, as the Midland City Council will purchase the Motorola Astro P25 interoperable radio system using $11 million in funding available in an American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 grant and $6.587 million from the general fund. The system, according to the City of Midland, includes the cost for radio system towers, TDMA simulcast channels, dispatch consoles, 1,186 subscriber radios, subscriber services, and implementation services. This will allow us that joint operations capability beyond what we are able to accomplish, Herman said. A decision was made at this year's City Council retreat to look into a new system. Herman said after the meeting Tuesday that the old system has proprietary and technology issues, and the change will help MPD to adapt to the growth of the Midland-Odessa metropolitan area and the group effort happening to deal with criminality across the region. We're getting closer to one another, and we're sharing the same criminals we have for a number of decades, Herman said. So it just makes sense to be able to talk to each other. It's going to be better for the citizens, it's going to be better for everyone, and public safety. City documents show that agencies that use the current Harris system include Midland ISD, Midland Memorial Hospital, and Midland College. This article is entitled Permian Basin Giving Tree Donations Include 3,000 Toys by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Organizers of the Permian Basin Giving Tree reported that more than 3,000 toys were collected and were given to local foster kids on Tuesday. The Permian Basin Giving Tree was a success this year, and many local foster kids will have a wonderful Christmas, Giving Tree officials said. All thanks to the generosity of our community. Local organizations such as One Accord for Kids, the Attic Foster Network, and the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services took part in the Permian Basin Giving Tree. Officials noted about 300 kids that were part of the Giving Tree this year. Donations included 15 bikes, toys, clothes, jackets, and shoes. This article is entitled Craddock Elected to Fourth Term as Railroad Commission Chairman by Mella McEwen. Midlander Christy Craddock celebrated 10 years on the Railroad Commission by being elected chairman of the three-member panel for the next year during Tuesday's open RRC meeting. She succeeds Wayne Christian as chairman. "I am honored to be elected again by my fellow commissioners to serve as chairman," Craddock told the Reporter-Telegram by email. As she steps into her fourth term as chairman, Craddock's focus will be on continuing the agency's IT upgrades, protecting the state's most important industry from federal overreach, and providing regulatory certainty to oil and gas operators who make up one-third of our state's economy, she wrote. Craddock also expressed her appreciation to Christian for his leadership during the past year. "Chairman Christian has led this agency through serious rulemakings related to Winter Storm Uri, and I am proud of the work this agency has completed to keep gas flowing in this state," she said during the open meeting. With the Texas legislature scheduled to meet beginning in January, Craddock will be representing the agency at the state capitol. Working to secure the agency's budget for the next biennium, and working with legislators to prevent federal overreach into the state's most economically important industry. She said during the meeting that another top priority is continuing to ensure the health and safety of all Texans through responsible regulation of the state's natural resources. This article is entitled, Ethnos Group Offers Pastoral Tools for Church Leaders, by Doug Lamb, Ethnos Group. Editor's note, this article from Ethnos Group is another in the series from a local nonprofit highlighting its service during the giving season. If your organization has a message to send out to Reporter Telegram readers during the month of December, please send it to sdoreen@hearstnp.com. With the right tools, you can accomplish any job. That's what my father always told me. And, in a nutshell, that's the guiding principle of Midland-based Ethnos Group, which aims to provide much-needed pastoral tools, training, and leadership skills to pastors and leaders in churches around the world. It's a pressing need that I only became aware of in the late 1990s when I began traveling to countries in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, Asia, and the Americas. In fact, according to one of the world's most prominent missionary organizations, the Lausanne Movement, only about 5% of the church leaders have been trained for pastoral ministry. The Ethnos Group targets the remaining 95% of those leaders with the kind of training that can help create prosperous and growing ministries. With the right training, the right tools, these leaders can learn to amplify and expand their effectiveness in building strong spiritual communities. In addition, those who receive training can then in turn train others. The impact of the Ethnos Group is one that will echo throughout eternity. Your contributions to the Ethnos Group will help us provide hands-on, face-to-face instruction to under-trained leaders in remote locations around the world. We also work with orphans and widows and provide assistance to people seeking to participate in mission work. As the longtime pastor of Fannin Terrace Baptist Church and a 30-year resident of Midland, I have continually been amazed by the generosity of this community. I thank you in advance for any help you may be able to provide. The work of the Ethnos Group was paused during the pandemic, but we are now ready to move ahead at full speed. For more information about the Ethnos Group and my background, please visit www.ethnos-group.org or www.douglaslamb.com. If you have questions, please contact me through my website. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Ethnos Group, please make your checks payable to the Ethnos Group and mail them to the Ethnos Group, care of 2800 Mogford Street, Midland, 79705. This article is entitled, Police Continues Search for Suspects in Deadly Shooting, by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward for any information that helps solve a West Midland homicide. On November 30th, at about 5 p.m., the Midland Police Department responded to the Renew Andrews Apartments located at 1902 North Midland Drive in reference to shots fired. Officers found a 17-year-old male victim who sustained multiple gunshot wounds to his body. The victim was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, where he was later pronounced deceased, according to Midland Crime Stoppers. During the course of the investigation, it was discovered that there were multiple suspects involved in the shooting who fled the scene in a white four-door vehicle. If a person has information about the suspect, call the hotline. Go to www.694tips.com or use the mobile app P3TIPS. A person could earn a $1,000 cash reward if the tip leads to his arrest. No caller ID is used, and callers will remain anonymous. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Energy Stocks Predicted to Beat the Market, by Jeffrey Morgan, Bloomberg. Energy shares are set to trounce the broader U.S. market for the second straight year, and most Wall Street analysts see that run extending into 2023, for one key reason. They're still the cheapest stocks around. This year hasn't been a close contest. Energy has soared about 55% in 2022, which would be a record annual gain, while the runner-up among the 11 major S&P 500 index segments is barely positive. The gap drives home how much of an oasis the industry has provided in an otherwise abysmal year for shareholders. With questions swirling around the outlook for 2023 as the Federal Reserve's policy tightening spurs angst over a possible recession, energy bulls say the industry still looks attractive. They point to valuation. No S&P 500 sector has a lower price-to-earnings ratio, and to projections that oil prices will stabilize, in part amid the war in Ukraine. Energy screens more cheaply than any other sector category, Ben Cook, a portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds, who expects oil and gas stocks to lead again in 2023. At the same time, it has the highest free cash flow yield of any sector. It does look like energy can three-peat, he said in an interview. The stocks are coming off another blockbuster quarter of earnings, after crude surged following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The commodity's price has since tumbled, but some analysts see it finding a floor with the war dragging on, Chinese demanding rebounding, and potential OPEC production cuts. The median forecast, among those compiled by Bloomberg, is for West Texas Intermediate to trade around $93 per barrel in 2023, from about $75 now. Bloomberg Intelligence sees a scenario where crude could rebound to $108. Wall Street is still more bullish on the sector than the overall market, seeing roughly 16% potential upside for the energy index over the next year, compared with 10% for the broader market, data compiled by Bloomberg show. What's more, 61% of energy index companies boast a buy rating, compared with 55% for the S&P 500. Earnings growth and steadily rising dividend payouts have been key drivers in 2022. That's the goal of energy management teams, to deliver that free cash flow so that people don't think of these companies as just a proxy for oil prices. Stacy Morris, head of energy research at Alerian Vetify, said in an interview. Granted, earnings growth is decelerating, leaving some analysts to conclude the companies may have just seen their last great quarter of profits. At Truist Securities, Neil Dingman expects 18% lower free cash flow for the energy sector in 2023, as the likelihood of a material price tailwind that helped most operators the past 2 years is minimal. In a research note, he also said he expects oilfield services costs to rise, making it more expensive to produce the same amount of oil and gas in 2023. And energy would hardly be immune to a potential recession. Morgan Stanley's chief investment officer Mike Wilson said last week that value stocks, including in energy, are vulnerable to the economic slowdown, and urged investors to position in defensive sectors like healthcare, utilities, and consumer staples. Others point to the divergence between high-flying energy stocks and the price of crude as evidence the shares are going to struggle. J.P. Morgan and Chase & Company's chief global markets strategist Marco Kalanovich encouraged investors to sell their oil and gas stocks in the short term, as energy shares have outperformed crude by an enormous margin. He expects share prices to fall 20 to 30% in the near term, then bounce back sharply. After that, we still believe there will be an opportunity to buy, Kalanovich said on a Friday webcast about the outlook for 2023. Energy stocks will rocket higher and probably again be the best performing sector in equities. This article is entitled Railroad Commission Responds to 5.4 Magnitude Quake by Mella McEwen. A 5.4 magnitude earthquake, the third strongest in the state's history, that struck Reeves County in mid-November, has prompted the Railroad Commission to shake up its response to seismicity in far west Texas. The agency said Tuesday it is implementing several revisions to the seismicity reduction response plan for its northern Culberson-Reeves seismic response area. One action being taken is to expand the boundary of the response area northward to the New Mexico border, increasing the size of the area from 2,366 square miles to 2,601 square miles. The revised area will now include 78 active disposal wells. Secondly, the target for reducing daily injection volumes in deep disposal wells is being reduced even further. Operators of deep disposal wells in the revised plan have agreed to reduce the collective volumes of disposal from the original target of 298,000 barrels per day by June 30, 2023, to just 162,000 barrels per day by that date. This equals a 68% drop in disposal volumes compared to January 2022. Additional changes to the response plan are expected. Commission staff are studying revisions to shallow disposal well injection volume schedules in the response, along with possible new data collection efforts. As part of the recent revisions, the RRC will also promote expanded data collection to support seismicity research to inform policymakers on future data needs for effective regulation to protect residents and the environment. The data collection will include a voluntary survey of available historical and current reservoir pressure, encouraging the use and reporting of continuous downhole pressure monitoring data, and assessing the origins of disposal volumes, whether from in-state or out-of-state sources. The potential lag time between changes in injection rates and changes in seismicity varies. Historical activity indicates a potential lag time of 12 to 18 months. This article is entitled OPEC Urges Caution as it Cuts Oil Demand Forecast by Grant Smith, Bloomberg. OPEC urged vigilance and caution on its members as it reduced estimates for the amount of crude the group will need to pump in the coming months. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries now sees a finely balanced market in the first quarter of 2023 instead of the deficit implied by its forecasts a month ago. The group's latest figures follow an 11% slump in crude prices last week on concerns over weaker fuel consumption. Doubts are growing over China's ability to abandon anti-COVID measures, and there are signs that monetary policy will continue to tighten in the U.S. OPEC predicted that the world's demand for its crude in the period will be 380,000 barrels a day lower than previously expected. As the year 2022 draws to a close, the recent global economic growth slowdown, with all its far-reaching implications, is becoming quite evident, OPEC's Vienna-based research department said in its monthly report. The year 2023 is expected to remain surrounded by many uncertainties, mandating vigilance and caution. OPEC and its partners have only just implemented a 2 million barrel a day supply cut, which was announced in October. Secretary General Haitham Al-Gais said over the weekend that the OPEC Plus pact is working by keeping world markets in equilibrium. The latest downgrade to demand offers further justification for that output reduction, which initially drew fierce criticism from the White House. OPEC estimates that its 13 members will need to provide an average of 28.93 million barrels a day in the first quarter of 2023, just a little more than the 28.83 million a day they pumped in November, according to the report. The group expects global oil demand to increase by 2.2 million barrels a day next year, to average 101.77 million barrels a day. This article is entitled, More Uncompleted Wells is Latest Sign of Shale Slowdown, by Mitchell Furman, Bloomberg. U.S. oil and gas companies fracked fewer wells than they drilled for the second consecutive month, the latest sign of a slowdown in American shale, despite relatively high prices and concerns about a global energy crunch. The number of drilled but uncompleted oil and gas wells, known as DUCs, rose by 22 from the prior month to 4,443 in November, the U.S. Energy Information Administration said Monday. That comes after a 27-month-long streak of declines in DUC count, the longest, according to EIA records, dating back to the early days of shale. Bringing a new shale well online involves two basic steps, drilling, then hydraulic fracturing, requiring separate crews who sometimes work months apart. The DUC count shows whether the shale sector is building up a cushion of wells, a so-called frack log, that's ready to be fracked, or whether it's eating into that inventory. The count started to shrink at the height of the pandemic when producers idled rigs and cut costs to the bone in the face of plunging oil prices. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, December 14th. Beverly R. Brown. Beverly Ruth Brown, 66, of Midland, passed away December 7th at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. Beverly was born on June 25, 1956, to Frank and Bernice Smith Kropp in Goshen, New York. She married Thomas Tom Gary Brown on September 21, 1973, in Binghamton, New York. She is survived by one son, Thomas Brown II, Ashley, 10 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, and 5 siblings, Don Kropp, Cindy, Steve Kropp, Cheryl, John Kropp, Karen, Tim Kropp, and Kathy Kropp. She is preceded in death by 2 children, Colleen Brown and Christopher Brown. Her parents, Frank and Bernice Smith Kropp, and 1 brother, Dave Kropp. A celebration of life will be held on December 15th at 10 a.m. at Cotton Flat Baptist Church in Midland, with Pastor Rick Holman officiating. Flowers can be sent to Cotton Flat Baptist Church, 6409 Texas 349 in Midland, 79706. Fred Leggett. Fred Leggett, 83, of Midland, passed away December 9th. He was born August 21, 1939, to C.L. and Thelma Leggett in Uvalde, Texas. He is preceded in death by his parents, a brother Clyde Butch Leggett, and a sister Dolores White. He is survived by his wife Eileen Leggett, with whom he shared 63 years of love and friendship, two sisters, Linda Richard Campbell and Melissa Carl Dotson, three children, Cindy Israel Patino, Douglas Deanne Leggett, and Glenn Kathy Leggett, as well as 10 grandchildren and 25 great-grandchildren. A memorial will be held Friday, December 16th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Military funeral honors will be presented at 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Wounded Warrior Project, Hospice of Midland, or St. Jude Children's Hospital. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Oscar Steve Watlington. Oscar Steve Watlington passed away on November 26th at the age of 80. He was born on November 17, 1942. Steve is preceded in death by his parents, Thomas and Mattie Pearl Watlington. Left to cherish his memory, his longtime companion, Angie Eppinger, brother Mike Watlington and wife Barbara, along with many nieces, nephews, and their children and grandchildren. Graveside service will be held Monday, December 12th at 3 p.m., at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Donations may be made to the American Heart Association, Animal Shelter, or a charity of your choice. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, and online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Death Notices. John David McKinney. John David McKinney, 69, of Midland, passed away on December 12th. The family will receive friends on Wednesday, December 14th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Thursday, December 15th, at 11 a.m. at Golf Course Road Church of Christ. Mariela Lozano. Mariela Galindo Lozano, 29 years old, passed away December 8th. Viewing will be Thursday, December 15th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service starting at 6 p.m. Thursday evening at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service is set for Friday, December 16th, at 10 a.m. at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. McQuester Glenn Walker. McQuester Glenn Walker, 59, of Las Vegas, Nevada, passed away December 2nd. The family will receive guests from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, December 18th, at the branch at NPW. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, December 19th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Tommy Keith Flood. Tommy Keith Flood, age 73, passed away December 7th. Cremation services have been arranged. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.asanchezTFH.com.
This is Thoris with Odessa American News, Wednesday, December the 14th. Headlines are Mariro and Brooks fired by city council. Norris vows federal lawsuit against city. City manager Michael Marrero and city attorney Natasha Brooks were fired Tuesday night during the city council meeting, in a meeting where the council was heckled and called out by citizens for firing the pair. Dan Jones was appointed as interim city attorney. Agape Purnell was appointed as interim city manager. The council went into executive sessions at 6:20 p.m. and were out before 7. Hispanic leader Carol Uranga took the council to task for firing Marrero. She praised Marrero as a leader who built coalitions and also mentioned countless Odessians. "He was somebody we could trust," she said. "He's a good man, and he knows what he is doing, and the city of Odessa has lost." Local NAACP leader Gene Collins told the council that they are elected to serve the whole community and not their own personal desires. "Your decision needs to be explained to Odessa. I am really upset because of some selfishness on a few people's parts. He is not longer with us. Natasha, you don't run the day-to-day activities, so actually you are out of order for trying to run city as if you're a corporation. You went and hid yourselves behind closed doors. We need a peaceful governing body." Local leader and attorney Gavin Norris complained the mayor disenfranchised his time and then told the mayor he was out of order. "I stand for District 1. You don't give a damn what citizens think," Norris said. He then called out Mark Matta, Denise Swanner, and Javier Hoven and told them the citizens want you to govern and you eliminated two people because of petty grievances. Norris says he will file a federal lawsuit against the city and the mayor, Swanner and Matta. He railed against Matta for being a puppet of Hoven. Wild applause followed Norris's speech. Rumors have been running rampant about Mario's job for months, but crystallized when the agenda for Tuesday's meeting was released late Friday afternoon. The move came just 1 month after three new council members were sworn in and 2 months after the old council met in executive session to evaluate the pair and three other council appointees. Councilmember Steve Thompson has been advocating on Marrero and Brooks' behalf since the rumors began, saying both are exemplary employees who are the victims of a power play by Mayor Javier Hoven and council members Mark Matta and Denise Swanner. The idea of reevaluating them appeared on the council's regular meeting agenda November the 22nd, but was tabled because the three new council members were sworn in that night. It was also on last week's workshop agenda, but due to the lack of quorum, the meeting was canceled. City Secretary Norma Aguilera Grimalda said Mayor Javier Hoven and Councilmember Greg Connell informed her in advance they would not be able to attend the meeting, but Matta and Swanner had simply informed her they might not be able to make it. Before Tuesday night's meeting, Hoven, Matta, and Connell declined to comment on the agenda item, saying it would be discussed at the meeting. Council members Swana, Gilbert Vasquez, and Chris Haney did not return texts, emails, or calls. Marrero, who was hired by the city in 1994, worked his way up the ranks. He was the director of the Community Development and Neighborhood Development before being named deputy city manager. He became city manager in May 2018. As such, he's been overseeing 40 departments and divisions within the city, which has roughly 1,000 employees. Marrero received his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Texas Permian Basin and his master's in public administration from Sewell Ross State University. Brooks started with the city as a senior assistant city attorney in 2015, after having spent 11 years in the same position in Midland. She was elevated to the top position in August 2019. Brooks, who obtained her bachelor's degree from Baylor University and her law degree from St. Mary's University School of Law, said at the time being a city attorney was a lifelong dream. Brooks replaced interim city attorney Gary Landers, who stepped in after Larry Long retired in 2018 when a sexual harassment complaint was filed against him. Shortly after her selection, Brooks said she hoped to update policies and procedures and work with IT so Public Information Act requests would be filled more effectively and efficiently. GivingTree to hand out over 3,000 toys to foster children. As Christmas music played over the PA system, staff and volunteers worked together to distribute more than 3,000 toys to children across the Permian Basin. This is the third annual Permian Basin Giving Tree that is spearheaded by local organizations, including One Accord for Kids, the Attic Foster Network, and the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. The Permian Basin Giving Tree is expected to give out around 3,300 toys and 1,600 clothing items to foster children. One Accord of Kids Associate Director Matt Waller said the Permian Basin Giving Tree will reach about 450 children. He said any toys that aren't initially distributed will be sent to foster closets and rainbow rooms across West Texas. There have been studies that show that if you can get resources to families in need, that's one of the primary ways to prevent kids from going into foster care, Waller said. We want to give them a great Christmas, but then also we are getting them clothes, hats, gloves, scarves, and toiletries so we can take care of them throughout the whole year. The process for distributing the toys is caseworkers will pick up the toys from Midland Bible Church, where the toys are being sorted and picked. The caseworker will then give the toys and clothes to families in need. Waller said he expects all of the toys and clothes to be distributed by Thursday and then clean up on Friday. He said he's appreciative for Midland Bible Church to use their facility. It means a lot to us, Waller said, of being able to use Midland Bible Church. We are able to spread out. We are able to get everything in here. You not only need a space that's available, but you need a really big space. It's also pretty dynamic because we are working here, storing things in another location, and then things are available for pickup in a third place. We are fortunate that Midland Bible Church is really accommodating. Everywhere that we've been has been really accommodating. This year, it has really grown, so we've been in a position that needed a large, dynamic space. Shauna Todd, executive director at the Attic Foster Network, said she didn't know what to expect this year with inflation. The third year of the Permian Basin Giving Tree marked the highest number of toys the event has ever received. We weren't sure, with inflation the way it is, what would come in. Todd said, people have been more generous than ever this year. We've just had an influx of items, and that's really been cool to see. The biggest ticket item the Permian Basin Giving Tree received was a Nintendo Switch. Waller said that item already has a home, and it will be donated to High Sky Children's Ranch. They can't regulate it, Waller explained about donating the Switch to High Sky. I feel like that's an honorable way to treat that donation. With an expansive number of toys and clothes ranging from toddlers to teenagers, Wallers said it's important to organize the toys and clothes. Todd also explained it's important that workers and volunteers know how to pick correctly, especially when it comes to clothing for children. The request form that workers and volunteers use to pick with have likes, and some have specific sizes for children. It's interesting to try to figure out what size of clothes kids wear, Todd said. It's great when the caseworkers with specific information, but if they don't, we can kind of help volunteers figure out developmentally where they are and size-wise where they are at. We just kind of work together on those things. Odessa man accused of aggravated assault. An Ector County man was arrested Monday after his mother accused him of threatening to stab her and pushing her grandson. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, A 57-year-old woman called 911 for help from her home in the 2800 block of Iola Avenue. When deputies arrived, she told them she and her son, Octavio Cabero de Leo, got into an argument at the HEB on Iola Avenue and West University, and he took her 4-year-old autistic grandson home. When she got home a short time later, the woman said her son, who was intoxicated, began to destroy items inside their house, pushed her to the ground, and threatened to stab her while looming over her with a large knife, the report stated. She said he also pushed her grandson against a couch. DeLeo was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, family violence and injury to a child or disabled individual, and family violence. DeLeo remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday afternoon on surety bonds totaling $40,000. Murder trial underway in Odessa. An Andrews Police Department officer testifying in the murder trial of Humberto Polanco told jurors he warned Veronica Carrillo she was in danger. "I told her she needed to find a way out of the situation or she'd end up dead," said Officer Anthony De La Cruz. He and other officers of the APD had been to so many domestic violence and mental health calls at Polanco's house. Officers knew they shouldn't respond to the home alone, De La Cruz testified. Polanco, 37, is accused of purposely striking Carrillo, 38, with a Chevy Tahoe on December 20, 2020, near 16th Street and Moss, killing her. He's also facing two additional charges, failure to stop and render aid and tampering with evidence in the Ector County District Court. Prosecutors John Briggs and Courtney Williams called Carrillo's sister, Rebecca Gutierrez, as their first witness. Gutierrez told jurors Carrillo was one of 8 children and she herself had 4 children and 2 grandchildren. Her sister began dating Polanco about 2 years prior to her death, Gutierrez said. Their first month together was fine, but Polanco quickly turned into a jealous, violent, and abusive man, she said. He was very jealous. She couldn't speak to her siblings or anyone else in the family, Gutierrez explained. She was the exception because she lived roughly half a block from Polanco and his parents. Her sister often came over to escape the abuse, but Polanco also came over and would start fights, she said. She also often overheard fights between her sister and Polanco, Gutierrez said. Whenever her sister came to her home, she was forced to leave her cell phone behind by Polanco and his mother, and then, Gutierrez said, her sister would have arguments with Polanco using her phone while it was on speaker. Gutierrez testified she called the police multiple times in the months leading up to her sister's death and hours before her death. She overheard Polanco tell her sister she was going to get it. In November 2019, Gutierrez testified Polanco showed up at her house covered in blood, saying her sister had thrown herself out of a vehicle. He claimed he didn't know where she was, and the family found her at Midland Memorial Hospital in an induced coma with head injuries, facial fractures, broken arms, and other injuries. After her sister spent months in the hospital, Gutierrez said she would ask her what had happened that night, and her sister would start to cry, change the subject, and say she didn't remember. Her sister sought help for anxiety and fearfulness after the incident, but did not take the medications prescribed to her, Gutierrez said. Her sister continued to live with Polanco even after he fired a gun at both of them in February 2020, Gutierrez said. It wasn't until October 2020, when he went to jail for assaulting her, that she moved out of the house, Gutierrez said. However, she did maintain contact with him, she said. On December the 19th, 2020, Gutierrez said her sister went to her oldest grandson's birthday party and spent the night at their mother's home in Odessa. She got a call from her mother around midnight, December the 20th, telling her of her sister's murder, she said. Under cross-examination from defense attorney Michael McLeish. Gutierrez said police investigated the incident that landed her sister in the hospital and no arrests were made. When asked if her sister jumped out of the vehicle on the night of her death, Gutierrez replied, "No, sir." She testified police told her she didn't jump. Gutierrez told McLeish she personally took her sister to a mental health appointment once, but acknowledged she doesn't know if she had other appointments or if she could have taken her prescribed medications and not told her. Williams told jurors evidence will show Polanco came to Odessa the night Carrillo died, picked her up in a black Tahoe, and a couple hours later intentionally struck her and left her to die in the middle of the street. Further evidence will prove Polanco went to a bar before being picked up by his mom and taking the Tahoe to a car wash, Williams said. McLeish and his co-counsel, Jason Leach, reserved their opening statement for a later time. Judge Justin Lowe is presiding. Each arrest looked at individually. It might look like there's a double standard with a string of students being arrested for making threats, but there's more than meets the eye, Ector County ISD Assistant Police Chief Jeff Daniels said. The department looks at every offense individually to make sure all criteria are met to ensure that it is an arrestable offense and we're doing the right thing to keep our campuses safe at the time, Daniels said. A recent Facebook post said a fifth grade teacher at Jordan Elementary School told students she was going to unalive them. A parent who was notified by her child tried to press charges and nothing was done. Said teacher has returned to campus today and was not disciplined accordingly, unlike a child who makes a threat, gets arrested and sent to the juvenile center, the post said. Daniel said that's not exactly the way it went. In every case, there are elements to the offense that before an arrest or citation can be made or issued, Daniels said, the statement was not made to anyone specific. The statement was to the teacher herself, just talking to herself over frustration with kids that weren't listening to her at the time. It was brought in as a concern from other staff. The kids never said anything, so there's no victim. It was just a concern because that type of statement was made. Do we agree it was a poorly made statement? Yes, we do. Is it a violation of the law? No, it's not. Daniel said he knows people are saying it's a double standard for students and teachers, but, quote, not every kid is arrested that says something, unquote. There are a number of students who haven't been arrested for making statements because it just didn't meet the elements of an arrest. We don't hear about those in media, but it happens every day on our campuses as well, Daniel said. It doesn't mean that nothing was done. There are still administrative actions that take place for things like this. They take their course. Just because an arrest was made doesn't mean nothing else was done in general. What has to happen for an arrest to be made? If we're talking about a statement made like what we're seeing on our campuses where kids are talking about guns, or bringing guns to school, there's a law that is specifically designed for that, for when a person threats, uses, or exhibits a firearm on campus, so just making a statement about bringing a gun to school is a violation, Daniels said. It's the threat of use or force or exhibit that would constitute an arrest. But you have to have a complaint. In every case, you've got to have someone step forward and say, I was in fear. And that's really what opens the door for us to work an investigation on that, he added. A number of times, we've had statements come in where I was walking by and I heard this kid say this. Were you in fear? No, they were talking and I overheard gun, and so I'm reporting it. In the society we live in now, we encourage our students and our employees report everything they hear that could be alarming or concerning. So they are doing what they've trained to do, and we look into that. Sometimes it constitutes an arrest, and sometimes it doesn't. But every crime has to have a victim in place, whether it be the state of Texas or an individual person, for us to be able to act as law enforcement. Daniel said they have to conduct an investigation on every incident that's reported. We receive reports every day over maybe just suspicious activity or something someone's overheard. Almost every day, we conduct an investigation over something like that in our district. 9 times out of 10, it turns out to be nothing. But there are those cases where, yes, it was said. Yes, it did put someone in fear of their safety. Unfortunately, as law enforcement, we've got to come in and make an arrest and keep our campuses safe to prevent things like this from happening. On the law enforcement side, Daniel said, they gather the facts and determine if there is probable cause to say a crime has been committed. Then we follow the process that are mandated by law for us to make an arrest on certain cases, and we file those with the proper jurisdiction, he said. ECISD police have a memorandum of understanding with the City of Odessa and Ector County Sheriff's Office, where when crimes happen in their jurisdictions, they handle those crimes, and crimes that happen in ECISD's jurisdiction are handled by ECISD police, but they work together to ensure safety regardless of where the crime occurs. It could be a case the Sheriff's Department is working on that we're out assisting on, or we're working the case and the Sheriff's Department is assisting as well as OPD. We have a great working relationship between law enforcement and our police department, but typically, whatever jurisdiction the crime takes place in, that will be the reporting agency, Daniel said. Daniel said the school shooting in Uvalde has had a big impact. People are really starting to pay attention to what's being said around them and reporting what's being said, where in the past, these things may have been said all day long and the kids don't think anything of it. But we just live in that world now where you just can't take that chance anymore of not saying something. Everybody from the governor's office to local law enforcement are telling our students and staff, if you see something, say something. Report, report, report. Give us the opportunity to ensure nothing is there so we can ensure that everybody is safe, Daniel said. If someone is hesitant about calling the police, they can use Crime Stoppers and remain anonymous. They may use the P3 Tips mobile app or call Crime Stoppers at 333 Tips. Daniel said if they even suspect something or are worried or concerned about something, they can call. I know we're seeing a huge influx of it, but our world changed after Uvalde, especially in school districts. I think everybody's just operating at a level of cautiousness.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.